Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
WGN. Hey, it's Ann Booth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. This downright springtimey kind of Saturday. You know, if I didn't know it was the last day, almost last day of January, I would think it was like March because it is darn pretty outside, and I hope you are enjoying it and soaking in all of that wonderful sunshine. So today we have a lot to talk about here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be talking about iPhone sales numbers because they are looking different than they have in a very long time. And we're going to be talking about McDonald's earnings because those earnings also look a little bit different than they have in a while, as well as that menu at McDonald's. And we're going to be talking about the Sundance Film Festival because the business model is shifting just a little bit. And we think of lots of deals being done as people are screening their films, and things like Amazon and Hulu and Netflix are changing the way that's happening and really changing a lot of things for a lot of filmmakers. So we're going to be talking about that here a little bit later in the show. But right now we're joined by Tribune reporter Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, who has written a really interesting story that is on ChicagoTribune.com right now. I recommend that you go check it out. It is all centering around a report that was released by the University of Illinois at Chicago's Great Cities Institute. And in it, it looks at census data and some other information and sort of has prepared for us, in a sense, sort of a job report. But it's broken down by race and age demographics. And there's a really striking number in this report, and that is that nearly half of the young Black men in Chicago are out of work and school.
That's right. So this report came out as part of this annual hearing that the Chicago Urban League hosts on youth unemployment. And we've known that's a problem for a while, that youth unemployment has risen over the past decade or so. It has not improved very much since the recession. And one staggering statistic in this report was the one you just mentioned, was that 46.6% of Black men aged 20 to 24 are out of school and out of work. It's highly concentrated in the areas in the city in the south and the west sides that are, majority Black. That's where most of this out of school, out of work takes place.
Particularly of note in the story, North Lawndale, East Garfield Park, Englewood, and Fuller Park
in particular, of
the kind of highest concentration of this really shocking and unfortunate statistic about unemployment and not only out of work, out of school. And I think it's interesting how this compares to other places in the country, even in our own state, even other cities in our own state. But in Los Angeles and New York City, it's looking like 30-31%.
Right. So the national average is about 32%, 31%, and it's the same in the New York and Los Angeles. So comparable big cities don't have it nearly as bad as people here in Chicago.
And so what do we attribute that to? Is that part of how Chicago is really still such a very segregated city? Is that the lay of the land? Or is it a combination of a lot of things?
It's a combination of a million things, but yeah, I think that the segregation of the neighborhoods here is not uniquely Chicago, but particularly, bad in Chicago. We've known that for a long time, too. And it just keeps people, in this cycle of poverty. So those neighborhoods started to become difficult places back in the 70s when a lot of manufacturing left the city, a lot of the steel mills closed, and these anchor employers were gone. And so people were out of jobs. Then drugs came along, crack came along. And so starting around then, the mid-70s to 80s, they just kind of started to go downhill. So if you look at data from back then, it's not that different. It's just things have not improved because people grow up, in these poor neighborhoods. They don't have opportunities. They don't see better. Businesses leave, retail. How do they pick where they go? They pick about income, about rooftops, all these things. And they don't see that there, so they don't go there. So there are no jobs in the neighborhoods. Transportation's a big issue. Just getting to a job downtown in the suburbs, whatever, is really hard for people when they don't have cars or when it's a dangerous place to be, so they don't want to take public transportation at certain hours of the day. So it just becomes this mess of a situation where there's no work in your neighborhood and you can't get to the work where it does exist.
Even safely or at all. Right. And that's this awful self-perpetuating kind of cycle with all these factors in there to kind of thwart people all along the way. So who is doing something to fix it, and who's kind of working to improve this, and what on earth are they doing?
Right. You know, there are many groups that are dedicated to this, and they what do they do? You know, I mean, it's a lot of outreach to youth and just showing them that there are opportunities. There's a lot of, like City Colleges, for example, is revamping its system so that it's focusing its individual schools on certain vocational concentrations so that they're preparing people for jobs that are needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a lot of nonprofits working in these neighborhoods, trying to work directly with the youth and improve their lot and just steer them in the right direction. There are lots of jobs programs, you know, where they're trying to get employers involved to give these kids a chance. Internship, summer jobs is a big thing, just to give them something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And to just give them enough experience so that then they can have something on their resume to show.
Sure. And it's that thing too, right? It's one of those can't get a job without experience, can't get experience without a job, can't get, you know, and at that,
right.
There's many cycles kind of all moving at once into this one big cycle in this whole narrative. And it's heartbreaking and it's, but yet compelling at the same time, because we're kind of just watching all of this happen and not, and it seems so fraught and it seems so difficult really to fix because there are all so many, you know, moving pieces to it. Well, it is a really interesting story. And if you want to go to ChicagoTribune.com and check out the story, the headline is "Nearly Half of Young Black Men in Chicago Out of Work, Out of School," says report. And go read that. There's a lot of great detail in the story that, of course, we couldn't get to today, but an excellent read. And we will look to you for updates on that. Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, thanks so much for being with us. Tribune reporter covering this and many other things.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll be right back here in just a bit on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and we are going to be talking about McDonald's because you know what? Their numbers are not looking quite like they have lately, so we're going to be looking at that here on 720 WGN, WGN TV. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We still have tons to talk about here this hour on all the business topics on our minds. But in particular, we're going to be talking about iPhone sales here in just a bit because they're looking a little bit different than they have in a few years. And we're going to be talking about Sundance Film Festival because it is also looking very different, at least from the business side. But right now, we are talking all about McDonald's because speaking of earnings reports looking a little bit different, McDonald's is looking a lot better than it has in quite a while. Joining us to talk about that is Tribune reporter Samantha Baumkamp. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Happy to be here.
Always happy to have you on the show. And you always bring such interesting information for us. And so I think we've all kind of heard anecdotally, McDonald's is doing better. They're doing breakfast all day now and all of that. But when they actually turned it, when we start really looking at the sales performance, it is not just anecdotal. They're really doing quite a bit better than they have in a long time.
Right. Last quarter, they hit their first improvement in the U.S. in 2 years in a key sales metric that Wall Street and everyday customers look at. And this last week, they reported that it continued in the fourth quarter. So we've really got a little bit of a streak here and seems to be that all the changes they're making are really starting to pay off.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think we've known there were changes coming and we've kind of heard rumblings of that and we've seen some evidence in some of the stores and we've seen quarter after quarter of just down, down, down numbers. And this past one really has turned things around quite a bit. And so a lot of that, because it's the menu, so we're looking at breakfast all day and that's really kind of what they're pegging this on. But there's, I think, talk too of other changes they're making to them, I think, as people are getting more health conscious.
Right. It's a slew of different changes. It's everything from honing down bloated menus that got way too big over the years and just really confused people about what McDonald's was trying to do. Are you trying to be healthy? Are you trying to cater to people with kale and salads and apple slices? Or are you trying to just stay to the classic Big Mac and quarter pound over cheese? What do you know?
Right. Because I think having the option of kale or a quarter pounder. It's like kind of a mixed message.
Yeah,
I think.
I don't want both. I just want my junk food. But then, you know, they're making those big choices and those big decisions out in Oak Brook at the headquarters, but they're also making little changes like adding real butter to the Egg McMuffin and instead of margarine and toasting the buns longer. So, and then working on speed and operational efficiency from the top down, really trying to tinker with those little things that really will make the difference to the customer.
And it seems like at their Oak Brook headquarters that they've really taken a very thoughtful approach. As you note in the story that you have at chicagotribune.com, they have, you know, sought the advice of chefs and food scientists and nutritionists and a lot of different points of view and areas of expertise within food, not just about taste, not just about items and cost maybe, but really a kind of a more thoughtful approach, which I think is necessary given how the consumers are a lot more savvy now. And I think McDonald's probably has a little bit of, had anyway, some negative yardage after like the pink slime thing that happened
Absolutely.
A few years ago, right? I think they had to come out with something a little more thoughtful and show that they're taking their food very seriously.
Right. And that's why I love doing this story in particular, because it was really an inside look at all the things that go into the planning, the testing, the tweaking of the menu items. They have an executive chef that's come from fine dining. You know, he has the resume of someone that could work in the best restaurant in Chicago, and yet he's leading McDonald's in this effort. He's been there for more than a decade now, but really he and the head of menu strategy told me that this is the most exciting time to work at McDonald's right now because of the way they're changing things. They start out with a taste test in the test kitchen and bring in food scientists and marketing, business insight, and all kinds of facets of the business to develop a new menu item when it happens. And then they go along this standard kind of methodical look at how to develop and finally get on an end menu. But the key difference in the last year is that this kind of process from, Oak Brook first developing a plan for it and putting it into a restaurant would take 2, 3, 4 years. And now we're seeing this happen in a matter of months. All day breakfast is an example. The idea, from idea to execution was 9 months, which is
lightning speed in a corporate setting, definitely.
Absolutely, especially when you consider all the things that go into it, like adjusting all the kitchens and the mm-hmm. grills and training. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's really just a monumental effort on behalf of McDonald's to really get some new customers in that hadn't approached McDonald's before, hadn't really considered it as much, and then bringing some old customers that it lost.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, of note in the story that you have at ChicagoTribune.com is about the regional items, which is really interesting. I've seen
right.
that before. I remember seeing green chili as an option in New mm-hmm. Mexico once at a McDonald's that I like. It was up on the sign that said the green chili burger is back. And I was like, well, that's interesting and something you would never see in Chicago ever. But lots of things of note, like sweet potato fries being tested in like Texas and
right.
that area, and breakfast bowls in California and things like that. And I think that's interesting. It probably speaks to a consumer demand. I would say attitude, but really demand right now for that local. I think even people that don't consider themselves really passionate about the local war movement, I think still on some level understand or at least favor some regional flavors.
Right. And it's interesting. That was by far the most fascinating thing of doing this story for me, is finding out when McDonald's does develop a new menu item or it wants to kind of test run it, that it has these certain regions where it reliably depends on the franchisees to test it out. Like, for example, the Northeast is a huge coffee market. You know, people running in New York City, you can picture it, businessmen running in for a coffee and not much else. And then in Atlanta, chicken is an extremely popular item. So when they're testing chicken wraps or the new buttermilk chicken that was mm-hmm. introduced this year, they test it there. Texas, obviously, is a big burger market. They like their meat down there.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have all these parts of the country where really we can really reliably look and see McDonald's can get a sense of what those people think of it.
That's so interesting. And I always think it's interesting to take a look at the franchisee corporate relationship? Because sometimes it seems a begrudging one. Sometimes it seems a really enthusiastic one. Sometimes they're so different that they don't even seem connected. But I think McDonald's has from the start always had that, a lot of standards in place. But it is interesting when you see something that's so specifically regional. The last time I was in the New England area, I saw a sign for a lobster roll in a window of McDonald's that was kind of on a off of a highway. Mm-hmm. And as I was kind of driving through, I was like, well, again, there's another thing you would not necessarily be seeing in Chicago right there.
Yeah. And that's something that's probably never going to get rolled out nationwide. But then you take an example like sweet tea, which I mentioned in the story, mm-hmm. That was something specifically geared towards Southern restaurants. And it just gained in popularity so much that now it's on the national menu.
Definitely.
So, and things like that, they're constantly tinkering with things like that. That's why there's so many people up there in Oak Brook.
Right, definitely. Well, it's a really interesting story, and it's, we think of McDonald's as just such an icon of American industry that's just, been around in such this classic American success story. So it's really interesting to see them kind of taking a step back and responding to more local preferences and approaching their food a little more thoughtfully. So we appreciate you writing the story and appreciate you joining us today here on the Business Lunch. Everybody, head to ChicagoTribune.com and read Samantha Baum Camp's story, How McDonald's Menu is Made and How It's Changing. Thanks so much for being with
Thank
us today.
You.
We'll be right back here in just a bit on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Interesting things happen when we rely on technology a little too much sometimes. There's a great story at Wall Street Journal. .com. Rob, I wonder if you've seen this story too. It's really an interesting one. It's all about how when online maps screw up and they have given something inaccurate to the customers, and then businesses get blamed for this. And it's a really interesting story. It's just kind of a lighter read. It's not heavy with stock market numbers or anything like that. But certainly it is, you think about it. You go, okay, I need to go to business XYZ, and you Google it and you look at the map and you assume that it's accurate. We trust our maps and all of those things. And then we go to this business and it's nowhere in sight, not even close. And then, of course, a lot of consumers take that out on the business. They don't necessarily blame the map company. They'll blame the business. So there's an interesting story, like I said, on WallStreetJournal.com, all about when online maps screw up and hurt small businesses. It turns out they're really rife with errors. There's a lot of errors in them. But as I was reading it, of course, what came to mind for me, and Griffin and Rob, weigh in here if you like, because I'm sure you've seen this too, is when you go to Google Maps or something and you see something that should not be on the map. Have you ever seen something like that, right? You see just a random person, sitting, displayed awkwardly or doing something weird on there. And one story comes to mind in particular. There were some teens in England who, when the Google mapping, the mapping trucks went through taking video and photo of everything around them, they caught these teenagers skipping school and engaging in some heavy petting in the backyard. And so they were kind of they were neighbor kids, and they were sort of between the two houses in the back, and they were fooling around and caught. And they were, as a result, they were right there on Google Maps and busted when someone from the neighborhood was looking at the neighborhood, right? Looking at the neighborhood on the maps and realize, wait, those are my neighbor's kids. So I think the mapping thing is very interesting, and it's not without error. We cannot depend on robots to be 100%, right? All right. So moving on, we have to talk about maps a little bit, but I also want to talk about another part of technology, and that is the iPhone. And the iPhone sales are looking a little bit different than they have before. A story on WashingtonPost.com written by reporter Haley Tsukuyama, who is joining us now by phone. Hi, Haley. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Great. Thanks for being with us. I read with great interest your story about sales of iPhones and how they've grown at the slowest pace since the smartphone was introduced. That really does not sound like very good news for Apple, considering the iPhone sales are about 60% of its overall revenue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely an interesting quarter. I think a lot of analysts had expected to see a slowdown in growth, but It's certainly not what we're used to seeing out of the iPhone.
And so when analysts predicted that slowdown, was it just based in we figured we would hit kind of peak smartphone at some point, or was it around other revenue from other products they've introduced?
Yeah, I think it's mostly, you know, mostly looking at the smartphone. As you said, Apple is essentially an iPhone business if you just look at purely at where its revenue comes from. And yeah, it's just one of those things. The smartphone market has matured to a point where a lot of people who are going to get a smartphone have a smartphone.
And so did you get the sense anyway in working on this story that maybe Apple had higher hopes for the Apple Watch and hoping that it would start to go a little more mainstream and make up for revenue before iPhone sales started to level off and plateau?
You know, I think Apple, you know, they've been pretty realistic about what the Apple Watch growth is going to look like. And I think they forecast to everybody to say, you know, maybe the wearable revenue won't pick up exactly what we lose in the iPhone right away. So I think a lot of the industry is sort of in an interesting lull right now where the traditional products that have made them the most money are sort of maturing to the point where they aren't growing anymore, but their newer products haven't quite taken off yet.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, that's a thing that's interesting about the Apple Watch anyway, is that was sort of the first new product that came out when Tim Cook was at the wheel. And so it was sort of, I think, all eyes on him to sort of prove himself as a leader. It was the first thing since he took over after Steve Jobs, right? So it seems like there's still a little bit of skepticism out of a sense of loyalty to Steve Jobs almost about the Apple Watch.
I think that is possible. I think, too, just in terms of, you know, sometimes products hit the market before people are totally ready for them, or, you know, some things just take time. So I think for a lot of people, myself included, the Apple Watch is often sort of a solution in search of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fine device. It works, you know, it works very well, but not a lot of people see why they need it yet. And I don't think Apple's necessarily delivered that message.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And I think, too, compounding this is when we see, I don't want to say competitors, because I think so many smartphones are so very different and speak to different people in different ways and around their different needs. But it certainly seems like the ability to offer smartphones at such a deep discount from other brands, of course, could not be helping matters either, despite, you know, such a high loyalty with Apple customers of their products. And, you know, people have often called it the cult of Apple, that people, you know, will have several Apple products in their home all at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And especially, you know, with Apple, I mean, Apple, of course, is very well established here, but they're looking at markets all over the world. And, you know, a lot of these people are more price conscious, right? And they see, okay, well, maybe I want an iPhone, but there's a sort of mid-level phone that works pretty well, that is much cheaper. You know, if they're going to get a new smartphone, for example, or their first smartphone, they may be opting for those options first.
Definitely. And you note in the story that is at WashingtonPost.com, you note that slower sales in China have been a particular cause of concern. Tell us a bit more about that.
Sure. So China is a market that Apple, I mean, that every tech company, to be clear, has been really trying to crack. And, you know, but over there, Apple is very much a luxury brand. They're very popular sort of with the upper classes, but just in terms of, you know, most of the population of China is not in those upper echelons of society. And so when they're looking at buying a new smartphone or their first smartphone, in fact, there's a lot of competition from specifically Chinese firms who are making fairly good phones at a very low cost.
Mm-hmm. And do you get the sense that that lower price point offered a year or so ago of the very brightly colored Apple, iPhones that were at that much lower price point from the, you know, pretty gold and rose gold ones. There was kind of the blue and the green and the brightly colored ones, I think, that were very popular more with, family packages and teen users. Mm-hmm. Do we think that kind of staved off this, you know, seeing this report or kind of helped to stem this a little bit? Would we have seen this sooner had Apple not offered that lower price point iPhone?
That's a little bit hard to say. I think a lot of what helped Apple was actually bumping up the screen size on its, not this past generation, but the generation before.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we really saw the sales spike up. You know, that lower cost device, it did do well sort of in some of those developing markets, absolutely. But it didn't quite fit with the idea of what people want Apple to be. And so they're also sort of in a tough spot. You know, people associate them with quality and luxury. And so it's a little hard for them to hit that middle market at those price points.
Definitely. That's a very good point. Well, it's a very interesting and complex story. I recommend everyone go to this at WashingtonPost.com. The headline is Sales of iPhones Grow at Slower Pace Since the Smartphone Was Introduced. And that story is by Haley Tsukuyama. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Wintrust Business Lunch, Haley.
Thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking all about how the big deals that go down at Sundance are totally looking different. They are looking so much different than they have in years past. And it's all because of Amazon and Netflix. So stick around. We'll be right back to talk about that here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today on this downright springtimey kind of day. Enjoy it while it lasts, my friends. Because if you know Chicago like I know Chicago, it means it's not going to stick around for long. It's always going to change. But enjoy it while it's here. You know, my friends, I don't know if you saw this story in the New York Times, but it is really fascinating about how things are shifting at the Sundance Film Festival. And it is so interesting. And it's one of those that you read and you go, of course that's going to happen because the things have been shifting the way we consume television, the way we watch movies, right? So many people now are not watching television live. So many people are watching it via Hulu or Amazon Prime or something like that. And so we tend to binge watch our shows. We tend to watch them on our schedule, not necessarily the network schedule. And anyway, the story at NewYorkTimes.com, it's by Brooks Barnes. It is a really interesting look about how Amazon and Netflix are playing in the Sundance Film Festival space. So I think the first thing we saw was that hit the film industry was suddenly equipment was a lot higher quality at a lower price point. And so we started seeing a lot more people having access to make films and compete in a festival setting. And then we started to see things just in the last couple of years kind of shift in the way the deals are being made. And Amazon and Netflix were showing up at these kind of these sort of festivals, these really big festivals where a lot of deals get made, where a lot of people, you know, the big studios like Fox and Universal and all them, they'll go and see things that they like and grab them and buy them up from these filmmakers. So while they were there in years past, they were just kind of lurking, you know, they were just sort of hanging out. What's very interesting about this year, so the festival, it's an 11-day festival. It started on Thursday. Amazon has already purchased four films. One of them is a film starring Casey Affleck. Amazon paid $10 million for the movie, completely beating out the big studios. Super interesting shift in the business model that we're seeing here.
And by the way, if you're already tired of Oscar conversation, the next year's Oscar conversation is beginning with that Casey Affleck movie. People are already predicting
really?
That that's going to be a big winner at the Oscars next year. We haven't even gotten to this year's, but anyway.
Well, I think so many people are boycotting the Oscars this year. You know, we saw the
this one's moot, so we'll just focus on next
like
year's.
This year's Oscar is the lost cause. Let's just go to next year and just kind of look at that. Well, that's very true because the Oscar conversations, you know, all the award conversations really do start at the festivals, at the big ones that we know. You know, the Toronto Film Festival, the Cannes Film Festival, certainly Sundance, and L.A. Film Festival to some extent, too.
It's true. It can get to be a lot sometimes, for sure.
Yeah. And I think sometimes it does get a little bit political because it's a bit of a social game at these festivals on some level once you're a bigger player, once you're a known contributor to them. So what's interesting is their approaches. So Netflix is focusing on building a global streaming catalog. They're not so much interested in that theatrical release. Netflix is, they're going to be looking for titles that they can release right there on Netflix, right? That they can, you know, that they can just share right then and without regard to a theatrical release, perhaps not even trying to do one, rather than, you know, risk it being a small or limited or unsuccessful theatrical release and putting kind of a bad narrative around the film. They're just going to go right to that. And indeed, we're seeing some really interesting series on Netflix. We're seeing some really interesting films on Netflix that maybe wouldn't have wide theatrical release, but nonetheless are doing wonderfully because people very much in a social media world communicate with each other about how, you know, how to watch and what to watch and all of those. I mean, when was the last time that you read a movie review and then went and saw it? I can't think of one.
It does seem like a very old-fashioned activity, because I remember being 13 or 14 years old, and I would get the Tribune, get the Sun-Times mm-hmm. every Friday, and I would read Roger Ebert's reviews of the movies coming out that weekend. And then for the Tribune version, I believe Dave Kerr was the critic yeah. back then. And then you would make your decisions based on that. But now, and I don't think I've actually read a movie review in the paper, probably since Roger died. But it's interesting to talk about the way Netflix has changed movie distribution, because I think one of the most amazing success stories, and this is Netflix-driven, is the career of Colin Trevorrow, who directed Jurassic World and will mm-hmm. now direct Star Wars Episode IX. His career was launched simply because a movie he made in 2012 called Safety Not Guaranteed was a hit on Netflix.
Yep.
And that's just amazing. He went from this indie movie or this small movie that just had a cult following online to directing one of the top grossing movies of all time. It's an amazing success story.
It really is interesting. I mean, there was even that movie, I guess, about a year and a half ago that was made entirely on an iPhone, which is fascinating. I mean, I think the first big one that really made us take note of that conversation was when the Red camera came out, right? Everybody went nuts for that Red camera because it was still, you know, not inexpensive, to be sure. It was still very expensive, but it wasn't at a level that was quite as prohibitively expensive to filmmakers. And so we saw filmmakers kind of pooling their money and going in on these cameras and suddenly being able to make really stunning cinematic work happen at this lower price point. And so I think that was kind of the first shift to a more, equal access sort of thing. So it stands to reason that these big companies would kind of go behind that and fall in line with that and follow consumer behavior in that way, which I think is really interesting. So joining us right now is Brooks Barnes, who wrote the story for The New York Times that is all about how Amazon and Netflix are playing in a much different different way at Sundance this year. Welcome to the show, Brooks.
Hi, thanks.
Well, we appreciate you being with us, and it's really interesting. We were just talking about how the different approaches here with Netflix and Amazon, where Netflix is really focusing on building up their catalog for people to stream online right. and are less concerned with a theatrical release. Amazon seems to be going a very different way and looking towards the people behind it, the awards they might get, and looking at it from a different perspective. Kind of break those down for us a bit.
It's basically the Hollywood way and the un-Hollywood way. Netflix is concerned about its streaming service in, I think, 190 countries now. And they basically do a theatrical release if they have to, if the filmmaker is basically insisting on it. Whereas Amazon is coming in and saying, basically, don't be afraid of us. We respect filmmakers, we respect theaters, trying to sort of woo the best talent that way by kind of acting like an old-fashioned studio where, yes, it's a streaming service, but all of these films that they're buying are going to be released in theaters first and like a full run and then on their Prime service.
You know, what this reminds me of is a lot of the narratives that were around print versus digital publishing in the journalism world. You know, it certainly mm-hmm. seems like, are the people or are the filmmakers that are really digging in their heels and insisting on a theatrical release? Is that the equivalent of like, I got to have that story in print first before it ever hits any website? Is it something like that?
It's a little like that, only, you know, given Hollywood, it's much more about ego in some ways. awards matter, especially in this business, and especially in indie film. It's how they get attention marketed. And so you really saw in the last go-round an example where Netflix kind of stepped on its own feet, where it was called Beasts of the Southern Wild. I don't know if you remember that mm-hmm. film, but they released it day and date on their service and in, I think, 31 theaters. And the theatrical result was terrible. And that basically communicated to this very elite little pool of Oscar voters that it wasn't a real movie, is how it was kind of viewed. And so, Amazon is trying to benefit from that by saying, we will make it not a B-list thing. You know, it's all perception, of course.
Yeah. Do you think those metrics are going to change in terms of the way we judge what is Oscar worthy or things worth our attention? You know, if we're only looking at the theatrical release and not huge numbers that are associated with what's viewed online, which I think most people are watching in that way, do you see those metrics shifting in terms of the kind of the gatekeepers of the awards?
Absolutely. It has to shift. And you've seen it on the television side already with the Emmys and Transparent. Mm-hmm. And in indie film in particular, you know, there's this, a few years ago, people wouldn't even consider selling to a streaming service. And now there really is a group of people, filmmakers, increasingly saying, do I care about getting my film seen or do I care mostly about getting it an award and on a big screen? And more people are saying, I care about it being seen and the check.
Right.
You know, indie film has the thinnest of thin of profit margins, and it always has. And if you've got two players coming in, you know, backing up Brink trucks in some cases, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to change the business.
Certainly. And so what about Hulu and all this? Where are they in this approach to you know, acquiring more content for their catalog?
That's a good question. They weren't very active, if at all, at Sundance. And so that kind of has put them off my radar for the time being. They're obviously doing a lot of originals. They don't seem to be quite playing or having the indie film strategy. That's the question I should ask them, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will be interesting, and it seems like there's a some smaller players in that space too that are trying to catch up quickly and jump in. And personally, I think that's exciting when we see moments like this, because it sort of requires a great deal of innovation and creative thinking really quickly, and because people don't want to lose ground. And so I think it's really interesting to watch how Amazon, Netflix sort of lurked last year and years prior at Sundance, and this year they're really aggressively making deals before even any of the big studios have done so.
They tried last year. I mean, they made bids. It was again in that what we were just saying, that the filmmakers were reluctant to do that. And just even in the course of a year, there's been a shift in that perception. You know, it really was kind of like a sonic boom or whatever loud metaphor you want to use when Amazon bought that drama.
Yeah.
Manchester by the Sea. And it kind of in the indie film, there have been only a couple instances where that really marked a change in the business. One was DVDs, which could help pay for this. One was the fact that when audiences just started coming to them, and now basically another area where you can actually get people to pay for these movies, which is not always that easy.
Right. And so what do you think we'll see this time next year at Sundance, if you had to predict?
It's so hard, right? Because the streaming services move so quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, at this time next year, we could see a lot, you know, them buying everything, or we could see Netflix saying, oh, you know, that's no longer our strategy at all. We're making all our own content. It's kind of hard to say from year to year.
Right. It's true. A year in internet years is like 10 years.
Right.
That's a much longer thing. It's hard to predict a whole decade of internet years. All right. Well, Brooks Barnes, thank you so much for joining us today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Go, everybody, to NewYorkTimes.com and check out this story. It's a really interesting look at kind of how the business side of Sundance works as far as filmmakers and getting those deals and getting those films sent to us. All right. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great Saturday.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, my friends, we're going to get you to news and all that good stuff, and we'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN.